Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for your patience. You've joined the Best Practices and Evaluations call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. Should you require any additional assistance during the call, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference may be recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Mr. Scott Jasik. Sir, you may begin.
Hello, I'm Scott Jasik, editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to today's audio conference on evaluating college and university employees. While many in higher education focus on the educational mission of academe, the reality is that all colleges are also employers, and all employers benefit, and employees benefit, when evaluations are done properly, and they all face risks when they aren't. Our presenter today, Kathleen Reinhart, is an expert on the professional and legal issues involved with hiring in academe and with supervising employees in academe. She is the general counsel at St. Xavier University in Chicago. Previously, she had an education law-focused private practice with numerous college and university clients, and she is a principal in the Conflict Consultants Network, which provides dispute resolution and academic consulting services to colleges and universities. During the first half hour, Kathleen will lead us through the PowerPoint you all should have received. If any of you didn't receive it, please email me at info@insidehighered.com, and I'll get it to you right away. Shortly before the end of the presentation, we'll let you know how to ask questions, and then we'll have a Q&A. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you very much, Scott, and hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with all of you today. I've provided quite a bit of information in this PowerPoint, which should be easy to read and to follow. And as Scott mentioned, we'll be reserving about 30 minutes for questions, but I also will invite you to follow up with any other questions you may have by emailing Scott or myself. We have kind of a sensitive topic today, and it's understood that many individuals on the other, all of you who are participating, may not want to identify with any specificity what may be happening on any one of your campuses, but we're prepared to follow up by email with responses to the questions that you may have. So with that, let's begin. And if you go to the next slide, the daily challenges that all supervisors, particularly those who are responsible to conduct evaluations and other decision makers make on campus, continue to increase. We know our jobs are hard, and they're actually getting harder. Two of the most critical challenges in terms of potential strategic and legal consequences involve effective hiring and the conduct of performance evaluations. So our focus today is effective performance evaluations, which in a number of ways also reflect the types of hiring practices we use and the hiring decisions we've made. The more effective our hiring processes, for example, the fewer performance concerns we may encounter down the road. With both effective hiring and performance evaluations, both of these areas typically will involve critical mistakes that can lead to conflict, to grievances, or to potential legal exposure. Moving to the next slide, our goal today is to provide a number of practical and effective tools that will serve you well during the evaluation process, along with an additional goal, and that is to propose a number of best practices in support of your campus supervision and decision-making responsibilities. The tools that I offer or recommend really came about as a result of many years of working with supervisors on campus at all levels of decisional responsibility, helping them to address challenges and to create some practical options. I also work closely and have for many years in conversation with many of my colleagues in the National Association of College and University Attorneys, and we spend a tremendous amount of time on a daily basis via listserv and through conferences to talk about the challenges faced through evaluations conducted on campus. Also, the approach that I'm going to recommend today comes about from the perspective of seeing too many worst-case scenarios occur on campuses. That is, grievances or litigation that occur as a result of an evaluation and a decision made therefrom, such as suspension, termination, denial of tenure. Oftentimes, when you peel those decisions back, occurred because many initial communications were poor, ineffective, or non-existent. Moving to the next slide. Supervisors, as all of you know, serve as the institution's front line. And as a result, supervisors have a number of ongoing responsibilities. Today's program is the companion, really, to the best practices in hiring program that was presented a couple of months ago. So for those of you rejoining us today, as well as for those of you who are new to this particular program, it's critical for us to take a few moments to review the fact that neither the hiring nor the evaluation process occurs in a vacuum. Instead, both are essential components of a supervisor's daily duties and responsibilities, many of those responsibilities listed here. Supervisory work, as I mentioned, is getting harder. It's critical to give some significant thought to the nature and substance of what we have to do every day, especially in an age of increased compliance and litigation. For example, all of the duties listed on this slide must be managed simultaneously. And toward the end of the program, with some additional time, I can focus a little more on some of the internal and external challenges. Moving to the next slide, what is important to remember is that effective supervision for all of us is really skill-based. It doesn't happen naturally, nor is it sustained without effort through additional or ongoing in-services. Further, what I would suggest to all of you is that as a result of compliance realities today and the nature of litigation, we really have entered the land of don't do this alone, and there's no turning back. And as a result, as I mentioned, of compliance realities, we must simply abandon the concept of we've always done it this way. Instead, we need to seek out support of essential campus partners that include one another as supervisors, that include legal counsel, that include HR. And we must commit to an ongoing preparation and training to ensure a much more reflective, holistic, and engaged approach to supervision. Going to the next slide, there are a couple of essentials. As I, over the years, have tried to break these tools down into very manageable, practical, accessible tools, I have essentially proposed the following, that one framework for all that we do, especially all of us who are responsible to manage, lead, and evaluate others on campus, is that an essential framework is that all we do must be guided by notice, clarity, and consistency. Those are the three fundamental pillars on which all of our work will be based. Notice of the rule or process, clarity in our communications, and consistency in our application of policy and procedure. Another tool that I've worked to develop over the years to try and encapsulate what it is we need to be aware of, and certainly I would suggest to you that this due diligence checklist is the combines the same set of questions that I would ask my clients at the point of a grievance or the point of some type of legal dispute. And so my effort is to move that much further forward in the process in a much more preventive way. And so the questions here, the five or six questions here, are essential in providing us not only providing all of us as supervisors a common language that we all can use in the management of our supervisory responsibilities, but it gives us a tremendous amount of information, especially as we go forward in a very challenging area such as conducting effective performance evaluations. Moving to the next slide, with these frameworks in mind, we need to also keep in mind that the number of legal claims faced by colleges and universities continue to rise. And in the area of employment law, poorly conducted performance evaluations are a major source of legal consternation to campuses. We give a poor evaluation, maybe a poor annual evaluation, and nowhere else in that personnel file either verbally or in some written form, has there been any prior indicator that this poor evaluation was coming? And so we need to take a look at how we can best contain these problems and instead focus on the conduct of improved evaluation. The origins of many of these claims, for example, can be traced to, were the processes and procedures clear? Did they provide sufficient notice? Were these policies and procedures consistently applied? Are our evaluation processes working? Do those policies and procedures create more issues than they resolve? This takes us back to the concept of notice and clarity. And how are those evaluation processes being used across campus? And this takes us back to the concept of consistency. Moving to the next slide. In addition, insurance carriers that work with many of the colleges and universities across the country increasingly assess the scope and cost of coverage based on an institution's engagement in the concept of enterprise risk management. And what this really is sending us a message about here is that there really is a need for a greater integration across campus and use of those tools that will permit the entire institution to prevent many of the grievances and legal risks associated with such issues as hiring and evaluation. So we always need to start from the premise, too, that everything we do and say as supervisors will be seen by someone, heard by someone, used by someone. Maybe not in a manner that we ever intended, but they will, what we say and do. There will be an impact in some way. And so keeping this in mind, it encourages all of us as supervisors to be more reflective regarding the actions we take. Going to the next slide. Therefore, as a result, we must critically examine our evaluation policies and procedures, including when and how often we conduct performance evaluation in services for our supervisors. We will be expected to identify and defend the decision-making frameworks we use, no matter the size of our institution, whether it's public or private. So moving to past the next slide that says evaluation best practices, and then to the slide that begins to talk about the best practices themselves. Consider the evaluations you've watched, been the subject of, or even conducted over the years. There's both a skill and an art to the conduct of effective evaluation. Effective evaluations focus not only on process, that is, the structure of the evaluation process. For example, do we use a Likert scale and assign rankings of 1 through 5 to an individual? Also, the process may focus on communicating the necessity and the value of doing an evaluation, such as, are these evaluations important to support the mission of an institution, important in the support of professional development? Make us better in terms of the services that we provide to our students, and also support our operations as a complex business enterprise. So on the one hand, as I mentioned, the evaluation process focuses on process itself. But evaluations also focus on substance. That is the manner in which we do our work, the personal and professional characteristics we bring to our work, and the dynamic nature of what we do. So, for example, in an evaluation, a supervisor might say to an employee that your communications to colleagues are always done with a sense of purpose and with respect. So you're tackling both the professional and the personal at the same time, and empowering that individual to continue to move forward and meet expected standards. So evaluation best practices, these evaluations must be meaningful, they must be honest, objective, they have to focus on factors that relate to one's performance and actually make sense to those who read them. We are not static as individuals, at least we certainly hope that we aren't. And so therefore, evaluations also should be continuous because our work is continuous. And evaluations, if we rely only on the annual evaluation and not any other discussion of how someone is doing within that 12-month period, then we are focusing on only on one snapshot in time and not providing the type of feedback that is really necessary and fair to provide an employee in order to improve or in order to maintain and sustain the positive things that they're doing. And the evaluations also must provide a realistic assessment of one's work during a specific period. Moving to the next slide. Evaluation should never be used as a threat or punishment, nor should they ever come as a surprise. This is a platform from which grievances or a legal claim will arise. So there is no evaluation that should in any way reflect a gotcha moment. We must base evaluations on firsthand knowledge, not hearsay. At the end of the day, it's going to be the individual who conducts the evaluation and signs off on it. That individual will be responsible for the information that is recorded in that evaluation. We also need to allow plenty of time to prepare and properly document assessments. We know what time of year this is. We know that we are multitasking right now at a speed and at a level that oftentimes seems uncomfortable and ridiculous. And as a result, it's very typical on many campuses to see evaluations left, the conduct of evaluations left to the last possible moment, especially if one is concerned about delivering bad news to a difficult individual. But leaving it to the last minute isn't going to improve the situation. And so one of the difficulties I've seen in the representation of clients is when evaluations are left to the last moment, that doesn't offer the individuals who are responsible to conduct the evaluation the time and the reflection to really begin to frame the evaluation in the way that it should be. Moving to the next slide. We also need to be willing to update the assessment if new information becomes available. And we should consult with HR and legal counsel if necessary regarding the tone and content of assessment. It's always helpful to obviously have another set of eyes taking a look at that evaluation. If you know you're going to be involved in conducting an evaluation with someone who may be difficult, with someone who may challenge you, if you, for example, if a department chair is a more junior member of the department and has to conduct an evaluation with a more senior member of the department, let's make sure that that chair has the type of support that is necessary. And HR and legal counsel can be very helpful in this process. Moving to the next slide. There are a number of factors that interfere with the production of effective evaluations, such as lack of clarity and consistency regarding expectations at the time one was hired and the current performance of daily duties. I have had the opportunity over 20 years or so to look at many evaluations at the point of grievance or at the point of some type of legal action. And unfortunately, especially if you rely, for example, on a Likert scale, and someone, you know, number of threes or fours are circled, but there's no commentary when the opportunity is there for commentary. There's often very little commentary that is helpful or productive or instructive. And so we're left with a lot of ambiguity, especially if the evaluation is in contrast to someone's performance currently. There also, we have to acknowledge, there's a tendency within most of us to avoid conflict in most ways, but particularly so if we are going to be working with individuals or have over the years been working with individuals who may be more difficult. Another factor that is a problem is poor preparation, as mentioned earlier, lack of timely implementation, and lack of follow-up. If we put someone on notice that something has to be improved, but then we don't follow up. We have created a shame on us moment in terms of the impact of that evaluation and its effectiveness. Also, we need to feel more free to seek out additional guidance and support. We do have partners on campus who can assist us in this process. Now, I also want to talk to you about some considerations when performance improvement or discipline or termination may be necessary. And so if you move to the slide entitled Can't versus Won't Analysis, again, I've tried over the years in working with many administrations to break things down into usable, accessible concepts. And for me, the following question is most fundamental and must be asked. Is an employee not performing because he or she can't or because he or she won't? This is a really wonderful, reflective question before we move into not only the final evaluation, but the issuance of an evaluation. If the answer is the former, that is, the employee is not performing because he or she can't, we need to carefully consider what training, what tools, what resources or other support should have been provided to enable that employee to meet established performance standards in the conduct of their duties and responsibilities. Once that can't question is answered, then full responsibility for one's performance shifts to the employee. So if someone cannot perform well because technology has changed over time and we have not, as an institution, provided the opportunity for that employee who we hired prior to the technology change to receive an update with regard to software or hardware or whatever it might be, we can do the same evaluation 23 times and we're going to have the same outcome. We want to avoid that catch-22 moment. In addition, what this question also permits us to ask as supervisors is the following. Have I, as a supervisor, actually ever told the employee what is expected, especially, as I mentioned, if those duties and responsibilities have changed over time due to technology, et cetera? Again, we never want to do or say anything as an institution that will become a distraction from the underlying issue, and the underlying issue is one's poor performance. I've had numerous conversations with attorneys on the other side who have said to me, my client is the greatest client of all times and clearly understands everything that was expected of him or her, but this person's supervisor never told him or never provided him XYZ. Again, we want to make sure that what we are doing and what we are saying never becomes a distraction from the underlying issue. So again, this brings us back to the concept of notice, clarity, and consistency. We want to make sure that all employees have notice of the established standards, that they are clear, and that they have been consistently communicated throughout the department that we are responsible to monitor or to supervise. Moving to the next slide. There are a number of mistakes to avoid, including, for example, lack of or inadequate documentation or competing personnel files. This is a major issue because oftentimes, candidly, there are dual files in academic affairs and in human resources. And at a point in time that I may be, for example, required to step in and assist because now we're at a point where this grievance may move into some type of legal action, I surely don't want to be surprised for the first time that there's a whole other set of files in academic affairs that I never knew about and that nobody else knew about other than academic affairs. And so coming back to the concept I mentioned earlier of enterprise risk management, we really need to make sure that there is a greater integration of communication between and among departments, because if an individual who is going to grieve or is going to take legal action against an institution based upon an evaluation that resulted in suspension or termination, that individual, as you all know, is going to file that claim against the institution and not against one individual. So from our perspective internally, we want to make sure that we are communicating effectively with one another. We also want to make sure, have we provided all prior notice and warnings that are required? Has there been any past practice that has trumped policy and procedure? And if so, why? And if so, should we have taken the time to update our policy and procedure to incorporate that past practice? What type of investigation, if any, has been done to find, to gather additional facts? Has there been an inconsistent or discriminatory application of policy and procedure? And what communications have we engaged in regarding that individual's performance? Consider for a moment that for the first time in history, we actually have multiple generations in the workplace, sometimes three, sometimes four generations, depending upon who we have, who still remains an employee and tenured on our campuses. Each of these generations has different communication styles. Baby boomers have become content over the years in many ways with the conduct of annual evaluation. Gen X and Gen Y, by contrast, are looking for much more frequent evaluations, oftentimes in 140 characters or less. And so we need to make sure that in our communication of expectations and standards that we are considering the different manner in which various generations that we are responsible to supervise are communicating and expect to receive information. There's an increased amount of literature now occurring that is really questioning the efficacy of annual evaluations and taking a look at what are some of the improved ways in which evaluations can occur, both in a corporate setting and in an academic setting. Moving to the next slide, when a performance improvement plan or some form of discipline, for example, is required, it's essential not to procrastinate. The issue is not going to improve on its own, and our wishful thinking that someone either leaves or retires or passes away is not going to happen. We need to be clear, we need to be consistent, we need to document. We also need to know the difference between legal ability and political will. That is, we may have the legal ability to take certain action, such as a suspension, such as a last chance agreement. But we also need to make sure that there is going to be the political will to support that decision up and down the decisional chain. So if a chair is making a recommendation to his or her dean or to his or her provost with regard to the need for some type of adverse action as a result of a number of evaluations, we need to make sure up that chain that there are not other institutional needs at that time that might preclude taking that action, such as fear of litigation. That doesn't mean, however, that there aren't alternatives that can be put in place. Instead of moving toward termination, for example, there's an opportunity to put in place a very strict performance improvement plan or to put in place a last chance agreement. Moving to the next slide, if suspension or termination is required, we need to make sure that policies and procedures are consistently applied. And we also should consider the due diligence that is suggested by the test of just cause. And even if you are in a private institution where just cause is not going to apply, this list still offers us a good sense of due diligence in terms of good questions to ask ourselves. Again, have we been clear? Have we been consistent? Is the policy or standard reasonable? Was there a fair and thorough investigation? Is the information that we have adequate? Has there been equal treatment, and does the penalty, for example, a last chance agreement, actually fit the evaluation? Moving to the next slide, if suspension or termination is required, Do we have adequate documentation? And has HR and legal counsel been consulted? This is a really important time to bring both of these campus partners in. And Scott, before I move to some additional faculty issues, I think you wanted to talk
about
the question.
Operator, could you please explain how people can ask questions through the AudioView system?
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, please press the pound key. Again, to ask a question at this time, press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
Another way you can ask questions, especially if you do not want your name or institution identified, is to email the question to me at info@insidehighered.com, and I will read the question without indicating your institution. But if your question relates to your status as, say, a public or private institution, note that in the question, and I'll ask Kathleen, you know, from a private college or whatever. Kathleen, back to you for the final portion.
If you move to the slide that talks about faculty considerations and starts with the first bullet, many of the underlying evaluation principles, faculty obviously is a different constituency to a certain extent. I would maintain that many of the underlying evaluation principles remain the same, but we do need to be aware of some of the other factors that may impact the evaluation process. Keep in mind that the nature and relationship between a faculty member and the institution typically is contractual. And that contractual relationship is reflected in the appointment letter, the award of tenure, in situations where faculty are represented under a collective bargaining agreement, the terms and conditions of that CBA will be applicable. Moving to the next slide. But in return for considerations such as the salary awarded to the faculty and other non-monetary benefits that an institution provides, a faculty member does promise to perform in accordance with established standards. So again, we have a fundamental contractual relationship here. In return for consideration, there's a promise by the party receiving the consideration to perform. The conduct of effective performance evaluations, then, is a contractual obligation that really is in the best interest not only of the institution, but also of the faculty member. Faculty members don't want to move through their careers wondering how they're doing. And the institution, also, it's in the best interest of the institution to know how those faculty members are doing. Consider the following. Colleges and universities that invest in tenured faculty appointments spend an average of $2 to $3 million over the lifetime of that appointment. So why would any institution not want to ensure that these investments remain productive? In addition, most faculty, the vast majority of faculty, also want this to be the case. They have not only the time and effort that they have invested in their scholarship, in their teaching, and in their reputation within the academic circle, but also in the performance of their job on a daily basis. It's helpful for them to know how they are doing, how their work is being received. So one of the other things to consider at this point is, you know, how you address those instances where we have a non-performing or poorly performing faculty member is also being watched by every other faculty member. And so what are the messages that we want to send to junior and senior members of our departments that we may be responsible to supervise and the individuals we're responsible to evaluate if we permit over an extended period of time an individual to simply say, those established standards no longer apply to me? And so it's important to be very clear with regard to what those standards are and the fact that they apply to everyone. If you move to the next slide, In a pre-tenure setting, we have annual evaluations, and in traditional, more typical tenure policies and procedures, there are typically annual evaluations. There's the third year reappointment process. And it, you know, too often, effective evaluations are not used as a means to either really reinforce for that individual on tenure track what will be expected of him or her, especially down the road to be potentially considered for tenure. And we too often don't use those effective evaluations to actually move an individual out and afford them the opportunity to pursue a career somewhere else, either at the end of the first year or certainly after the third year reappointment process. Instead, what happens too often is that we go through the third year reappointment process, we get to the submission of the tenure dossier, and now for the first time, the faculty member is beginning to hear that he or she is not up to the standards required in terms of tenure, scholarship, or service. Now, some of the factors that contribute to that is that, you know, we may have individuals along the way in supervision who are conflict avoidant, who have not been well prepared by others or well mentored by others to conduct these evaluations. We often have oftentimes a turnover of chairs in a particular department, so there's a lack of consistency in terms of message conveyed. And so what is really hoped for in this case is that we spend much more time together as chairs and as deans talking about these issues and making sure that we're putting in place the tools that will be helpful to all of you to conduct these evaluations. Moving to the next slide, all of the evaluations obviously must be clear and identify what is sufficient in terms of teaching, scholarship, and service to stay on track for tenure consideration. It's clear beyond clear in these cases. We also need to identify the difference if your tenure policies provide this. Most tenure policies will establish a baseline, a threshold for what is expected of each person on tenure track. But we also need to take a look at our policies and procedures to make sure that those policies highlight that if a particular department or school requires something more, that faculty members, you know, something more in a particular department in which the faculty member wants to be tenured, that those faculty members are aware of that something more, either in scholarship, for example, or some additional type of service. Going to the next slide, all of those policies and procedures must be consistently applied, not only to maintain or reinforce the integrity of the policies and procedures, but also to avoid any claims of unlawful discrimination. By the way, consistent application of policies and procedures, as I mentioned just a minute or so ago, apply to all, no matter how long one has been tenured at an institution. The longer we go in enabling an individual to avoid compliance with policies and procedures or other established standards, the more we actually compromise the integrity of those policies and procedures. And from a legal perspective, those policies and procedures now become harder to defend. Moving to the next page, a NACUA colleague of mine who is represents a number of institutions in the state of Vermont, Karen McAndrew, said it best in a presentation that she did at a NACUA conference. Tell them, meaning the faculty, what you're going to tell them, when you're going to tell them, and how. Then tell them. And tell them what you just told them, which brings us right back to the concepts of notice, clarity, and consistency. The heart of evaluation is notice of what the standards are and how those individuals are going to be expected, all individuals across all constituencies, how those individuals are going to be expected to meet those established standards. Some final thoughts on the next slide. There are a number of informal and formal evaluation processes that can be used. Obviously, the value of notice, whether that comes informally or formally, is essential. But there is one other item that I have used in the past, and it's not something that you can use too often because it loses its oomph factor. But it's what I've referred to as the legacy conversation. And that legacy conversation, you have someone who may be not performing up to established standards over a period of time. For whatever reason, either evaluations have been ignored or a combination of evaluations have not been as effective in providing notice. There is an opportunity informally to have a conversation with an individual and discuss with that individual what you are seeing, what you are hearing as a colleague, as a mentor, in an informal, confidential, off-the-record manner, so that that individual has the opportunity for notice and the opportunity to take some initiative to move forward in a different way, and to understand that this conversation is meant to provide some insight, to give the faculty member or an employee the opportunity to reflect, because absent any other change in that employee's conduct of their duties and responsibilities, that individual may very well leave the institution no choice but to utilize other formal processes following evaluation that may result in something that is not as palatable or not as not something that the faculty member is looking forward to. So it is something that actually I have participated in or have worked with others to engage in, frankly, at all levels of responsibility, from a trustee position through senior administration with faculty and with staff. And with that, Scott, I would be happy to take any questions anybody has.
That's great. Thank you so much. I've got more questions via email than through our system, as I suspected.
Sure.
But, operator, could you please explain one more time how people can pose questions via the system if they want?
Certainly. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, please press the pound key. Again, to ask a question from the phone lines, press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
And if you prefer to ask a question without your name, you can email me at info@insidehighered.com. Operator, could we have the first question in the queue, please?
Yes, sir. Our first question comes from Teresa Smith of Camden County. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. My question refers to changing technology and
yes.
job descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage that? Do you change the job description every time Word changes, or?
Or a secretary came in and she did dictation and shorthand, but now she's using a typewriter and Word, for example. And
how can you require them to keep up to date?
That's a really good question, and that comes up quite a bit. And I think that what's absolutely critical is to make sure that communications with regard to not only we are all operating within, frankly, a major business enterprise with very large budgets, and we have a number of constituencies that we serve, either internally each other in making sure that all of us can get our jobs done, but we also have external constituencies that we serve within the community. And we also, by the way, our fundamental constituency that we serve is our students. And so therefore, being prepared to meet technology differences is an essential function of the job. And so therefore, we need to take a look at what our job descriptions say. Do we limit our job descriptions by limiting us and identifying only certain software expectations that we have, or have we modified our job descriptions recently to indicate that, you know, the person must be prepared to meet and work with those software updates and changes that occur. Now, the internal responsibility we have, and this goes back to our can't versus won't question, and I've dealt with this very specifically, is to say to our Secretary A, we are going to provide you training over the next 2 days, or 3 days, we are going to provide you training on the use of this software. The expectation is that at the end of that 3-day period, you will be prepared to move forward in the use of that software. So if that individual refuses to use that software, that individual has now taken on the responsibility of not potentially being able to remain in that position, because this is the type of software that's being used by the institution and it's being used across the board. But if we start to make exceptions because, Secretary A says I'm uncomfortable in using XYZ, and we begin to make exceptions, are we prepared to make exceptions all across the board for secretaries B, C, D, E? Pretty soon we lose track. And now we have a situation where there's absolutely no consistency to our expectations or our policies and procedures.
Thank you, and thank you for that question. I want to read a next question via email. It was stated that the number of legal claims continues to rise.
Yes.
Are there any statistics or related numbers to support this statement?
Yes, there are a number of some of your institutions, for example, may be insured. If you're not self-insured institutions, a number of your institutions may be insured by a company called United Educators, for example. And on a semi-annual and annual basis, United Educators will provide to all of its insureds statistics with regard to the types of cases, the costs of cases, and they will break down the costs of cases from the initiation, the filing of the claim through discovery. For example, it'll cost you $50,000 to get through discovery. It'll also provide examples to say, and here's what it will cost from trial through, the start of trial through the end. So that, there's many statistics to say not only what types of claims are on the rise, but how much each of those claims are costing. And this is something that I try to make sure that there's an integration of information, for example, between the CFO or the VP for Business and Finance, where I'll facilitate conversations between Academic Affairs and Business and Finance so that there's an exchange of that information, so that everybody gets a sense of, okay, here ultimately is a type of cost that we want to avoid. And if we can avoid that cost by engaging in some different types of in-servicing and training for supervisors at a much earlier time, then we can utilize, we can save a whole lot of money for our institution. But yes, I would talk with your, because in addition to United Educators, many of your business and finance officers are probably also members of NACUBO, the National Association of College and University Business Officers. And there's a great deal, quite a bit of statistics that are provided through that organization as well.
Thank you. I'll read the next question that came in via email. Per your point on inconsistency,
yes,
we have been inconsistent in the past. What do you do if you want to start doing it right? Are we unable to evaluate people now because we didn't do it properly before?
That is a great question, and I will take the person who asked that question to lunch. That is a great question, and that question reflects a lot of reason why many colleges and universities find themselves in an inability to move forward. Here's what we have to do. We have to fess up. And when someone says, you never told me about this before, the response is, that is true. That day is over. If I stand, for example, before the judge and I do not recognize out loud to that judge and acknowledge the bad facts in my case. I am accountable for those bad facts as well as I am for the good facts. And so I think what we need to do is acknowledge the fact that, yes, there may have been poor evaluations or inconsistent application of policy and procedure in the past. That day is over. And as of this moment, everyone is receiving notice of how we are moving forward. And the ability to move forward is going to be applicable to everybody. So it's across the board that we're going to move forward. And one of the best ways to really begin to do that is many of your institutions may very well be institutional members of the National Association of College and University Attorneys. Your legal counsel, I can tell you as colleagues of theirs in NACUA, we are talking about these issues all the time and the means to move forward, to help all of our campus partners move forward on this very issue. And so it's worth having your legal counsel come in and talk to your department, talk to your school about this very issue. But the heart of the answer to your question is we need to acknowledge those bad facts and use that as a platform through which, you know, as a means of which we are now going to move forward through improved, clear, consistently applied policies and procedures. But in order to do that, we need to make sure that all of the supervisors who are going to provide those evaluations are getting the support and the in-servicing they need in order to do just what we're promising.
Thank you. Next question, also via email. If we've done everything right, and now we're getting ready to take an adverse action against a member of a protected group.
Yes.
Do you recommend that we do anything in addition to protect ourselves legally?
You know, I think that this happens a lot. It happens a lot in tenure cases. It happens a lot anytime there's an adverse action that is going to be taken, that when that adverse action, whether it's denial of tenure or some type of suspension or possibly even termination, the individual who is at risk because of performance is going to, first of all, respond and say, this couldn't possibly be me. It has to be based on something else. And let me share with you a couple of items. One is you want to make sure that you have everything that you believe you've done correctly. You want to review that with legal counsel in order to make sure that legal counsel has an opportunity to engage in some due diligence with you. Secondly, legal counsel is also going to tell you the following. In most circuits, legal judicial circuits in the country, if you hire someone in a protected class and within 3, 4, 5 years you terminate the same person who still is in that protected class, the conclusion of courts in most of these judicial districts is you knew the person was in a protected class when you've hired them. They now cannot indicate, say that you fired them based upon discrimination, based upon that protected class, because you knew what they were when you hired them. And so you need to keep in mind a couple of things, not only what your defenses are, such as what I just said, but you also need to keep in mind that even if that person wants to sue, that should never be a signal to you to not do what you need to do, especially if you have your documentation in order. Everything you've done reflects notice, clarity, consistency. You've worked with legal counsel. If that person files a claim, also keep in mind that the burden of proof remains on that individual to show that that adverse employment action is based upon some discriminatory act by the institution.
I have a related question that also came in asking about protected group status. What do you do when protected group status is only identified at the point of adverse action? So here I'm assuming it is a non-visible status.
And that's something that, again, so if it's a non-visible status, again, the burden of proof remains on that individual. And, you know, the reality is, if you know, it's a little too late in the game to say that something that was never discussed with the employer before, that now the employer should have somehow telepathically understood, especially if it's a non-visible status. If it is based upon, let's say, a mental health issue, where an employee never before brought forth information in the form of physician documentation with regard to a mental health status that constituted a disability or some other protected status, that individual doesn't, in addition to bearing the burden of proof, doesn't have the right to just offer this up at the end and expect that that's going to fly. And so I think that one of the things that kind of holds us back sometimes from taking the action we need to take is fear of litigation. But, you know, that is why you have legal counsel to work with as a partner in this process in order to help you and partner with you during this due diligence and to say, you know what, here's the nature of what they're claiming. Here's what's going to fly. Here's what's not going to fly. If you've done everything else that you need to do up to that point, you should be able to issue the type of evaluation you need to issue and expect that that employee is going to perform in accordance with established standards. And you should not be essentially told that somehow you have to be risk averse because someone is going to threaten a suit. Because that individual, that the action we take in response to that is going to be just as noticeable to everybody else who's trying to do the job that they're expected to do, in addition to the person who now is an unhappy employee.
Thank you very much. That's all the time we have for today. All of you in the audience will receive an evaluation appropriately of this program, and I appreciate your thoughtful questions, and thanks so much to Kathleen for sharing your expertise. To all of you, have a good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude your program. Thank you for your participation, and have a wonderful day. You may disconnect your lines at this time.